This is an interview conducted by Asher Gage, IET archivist, with Professor Nigel Lynch on the 5th of July 2023. The interview is taking place via a Teams recording as part of the IET Archives Oral History Project entitled My Story, celebrating the history of the IET and its relationship with its members and staff. Can I ask you to state your full name and position with the IET and any boards or committees that you sit on?
Okay, thank you, Asher. My name is Nigel Lynch. I am Professor of Telecommunications at the University of Salford. Presently, I do not serve on any IET boards or committees, but I have in the past.
Oh, that's great. Well, hopefully we'll get that covered in the interview then.
Yes.
So shall we start at the beginning? Can you tell me about your childhood and education, please?
Okay. I was born in County Durham in the northeast of England, and went to the senior school in Weardale in Walsingham, Walsingham Comprehensive School, as it was known then. And I did my O levels and A levels at Walsingham School.
Oh, right. Okay. And were you particularly good at maths or science? Do you have
always had an interest in maths, mm-hmm. physics, not so much biology or chemistry, but certainly maths and physics. Never really excelled at English or French or Latin. Oh, Latin was a... So I never really had the same, I don't know whether motivation or enthusiasm for sort of literature and so on. But
sort of the humanities side.
Yeah, but maths always enjoyed and physics always enjoyed. And as a child, always liked... construction type toys. So that would be Meccano, both metal and plastic. It would be Lego. And I had an interest in model railways, but also developed an interest in electronics. And that was motivated initially by shortwave radio. So I was quite interested in listening to amateur radio. But when we got, and I'm talking about my main school years being the 1970s. So as we got later into the 70s, my interest developed as a hobby in electronics. And so I used to spend pocket money buying different integrated circuits and making things at home, purely as a hobbyist thing.
That's very interesting.
And that was also the late 70s was also the early days of the home computer. And I had a Sinclair ZX80 computer. But prior to that, I had a Acorn System 1.
Computer. Acorns, yeah.
Yeah, it looks absolutely nothing like a modern day computer. But I did a lot of work with that purely as a hobby. So I've always had the interest in if you like, the engineering side of the world, less so the art and literature side of the world.
Okay, so it came quite early then, they're sort of tinkering with little tiny components and putting things together and taking it apart.
The putting things together, taking things apart was very much the construction kits, and in a Meccano and Lego.
Interesting, like STEM toys.
Without consciously thinking like that. It came kind of natural to me that I would build. I was always accused by my parents of, if I saw something on television, I would want to build it using Lego. So I never used sort of plans. I just made it up in my own head and made things, you know. And again, television wise, I was always interested in programs like Tomorrow's World, which looked at technology. And I was a big fan of children's television Blue Peter, which did a lot about you know, sort of practical things. And it was really quite an adult approach to technology as well in the programs like that. So I always really was immediately drawn to that kind of content, really.
Oh, interesting. So we were exposed to it quite early then through sort of children's TV and toys and things. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Yes, yes.
Oh, so engineering obviously came in via that route then. So maybe you can tell me about your engineering early career, how you're an electronic engineer.
So when I was doing my A-levels, the question then arose, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to university? Because remember, I'm talking about 1980, and going to university wasn't the same as it is in the 2000s. You know, it wasn't an automatic thing. Yeah. People didn't automatically go to university. You made a choice. And I made a choice that I wanted to go to university and study electronics. That had become my dominant hobby. And I felt that's what I wanted to study, something I enjoyed, something that I wanted to learn more about. And if you like, do it properly rather than messing about as a hobbyist and getting it wrong. Yeah. You know. And so I started looking at universities for electronics degrees. And so that's what I did. I got a place at the University of Salford for a BSc in electronics, and I started at the university in the September or the October 1980. Because the course was accredited, now of course I didn't know what these words meant at that time, we were automatically encouraged to join the then Institution of Electrical Engineers. And so as a student in 1980, I joined the IEE. Obviously, the deal of being a student on an accredited course, you remained with the IEE. So as I was going through my degree course, observing the people around me, the lecturers, I kind of thought, that looks like quite an exciting job, looks like a nice job, a nice sort of mix of things. But equally, to get into that sort of position, you did need to go beyond a degree and go for a PhD. So in my second year, I kind of was warming to the idea of becoming an academic. And I realized that in order to do that, you would have to study for a PhD. Now, I was fortunate because at that time, Salford had some externally funded PhD studentships. These were funded from the Science, Engineering and Research Council, then called SERC. And these were competitive, of course, but I applied and I got a first class honours degree at graduation. And I got one of those studentships. So I actually got a funded studentship to do a PhD, to stay at Salford, and to continue my work as a PhD student. So I went from being an undergraduate to a postgraduate with no gap at the same institution. People always told you shouldn't do that, but I did, and I've not had a problem with it. In fact,
no regrets.
Been there 43 years now, so it's kind of not done me too much harm. No. And it was when I was doing my PhD, my supervisor was the IEE. Do we call them the IEE counselor? It was the nominated academic that was the link between the university and the IEE. And because he's my supervisor, so he's encouraging me to be involved with the IEE in Manchester. And it was as a PhD student that I then got involved in what was called the Northwestern Centre of the IEE, and I joined the Younger Members Committee.
Oh, yes, so they're still very active, aren't they?
Yeah, so I joined the Younger Members branch or committee of the IEE in Manchester whilst I'm a PhD student. And I got involved in that activity. And of course, like all these committees, you serve on it for a few years in sort of as part of the committee, but then you quietly acquire these other roles, such as you become the secretary and then you become the vice chairman. Yeah. I never did the treasurer's job. That's the one I avoided. But I was doing the honorary secretary. And then, of course, because you were involved at that level, you then had to go and represent the younger members on the larger committee of the Northwestern Centre. So the Northwestern Centre was hierarchical, like they all are. You had a centre committee, and then the younger members was a subset of that. Yep. But when you became the secretary or the vice chair or the chair of the younger members, you then had to sort of step up a level and attend some of those other meetings. So I'm sort of on that trajectory, as it were. When I completed my PhD, again, I felt incredibly lucky because at that time, the University of Salford Electrical, the Department of Electronic and Electrical Engineering, which is what I was in, had a few lectureships, new lectureships. And because my PhD was in the very new area of computer communications, or so-called local area communications, it was a hot topic. It was a hot topic in the 1980s. And that was my PhD. And they didn't have, apart from my supervisor, a lecturer in that specialism. So they've got these lectureships. I apply for a lectureship and I'm successful. So I went from an undergraduate to a PhD to a lecturer, with no gaps, all at the same institution. And of course, I continue now my involvement with the IEE in Manchester, but now as an academic, not as a PhD student. But I'm still a younger member, so I'm still on the Younger Members Committee. but I become, obviously, the vice chair and the chair, and I get to sit on the centre committee. And that is amazing because the people on that committee were very senior people in industry. A lot of them, given it's Manchester, were more the heavy current, the electrical side. But you're meeting people who you would never have met before. Their seniority would have been a gap. They're working for Northwestern Electricity Board. I had no involvement with the Northwest Electricity Board.
So you wouldn't normally have
never met them. No. And this is the managing director. I would never have known the managing director of the Northwestern Electricity Board, but we're all sitting on the same IEE committee. And suddenly it becomes a leveler.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that I'm a junior lecturer. This is a senior engineer. That's a managing director. We're all actually sitting around the same table for the IEE, working for the benefit of the institution. And it's an amazing leveler. And the number of people that I got to meet because I was active in the committee in the region was amazing. And I would never have developed that network of contacts or get to know those individuals or indeed learn about those different industries and what they were doing and visit their locations because they would host the meeting at different company buildings. So you'd be at GEC or you'd be at Norweb or you'd be at British Gas, you know, various ones, depending on who the chairman was, would host the committee. And so you actually got aware of all these other organizations at a level which you could interact with people that you would never have met normally through my day job. And even if I had gone into those companies, I wouldn't have been welcomed at that level. That's not to say there was a problem, but it's just wasn't how it worked.
It wasn't
the IEE,
the levels to get
me on. All those barriers disappear. And that I think was a tremendous benefit. And then of course because I'd been active in the younger members, they encouraged me to join the centre committee in my own right when I ceased to be young, which I think was the age of 30, wasn't it?
Oh dear, how depressing.
And I got involved in the Centre Committee and the subcommittees of that. So we had something called the Learned Society, mm-hmm. which is basically the programme committee working out the lectures and things. And got involved in that. And the regional committees were always encouraged to nominate people for Savoy Place in London headquarters. Mm-hmm. And at the time we had special groups, special interest groups in Savoy Place. And so the regional committee actually supported my nomination to join things like the professional group in telecommunications. Was that called E7? I think it was called at the time. And there was another one called C3. And I got involved in those professional groups at Savoy Place. And so we could now, instead of running an event for the IEE in Manchester, we're now running a national colloquium in London, but in your subject area now. So mm-hmm. I joined the professional group electronic telecommunications E7, or the distributed systems, I think it was, and got involved in those committees as well. And obviously locally you then start going up the hierarchy of the local committee, and having been secretary of the Learned Society, I then became junior vice chairman of the centre, senior vice chairman, and then chairman. And whilst you're in those roles, you then have to sit on Senate at IEE, a council and so on at the IEE. So, of course, because I was then representing the Northwestern Centre, I came down to London to sit on the main committee as a regional representative, as all of the centres had their regional representatives. So I got involved in the IEE at that level as well in that way. So that local involvement led to national involvement with the professional body.
That's so, really interesting.
But equally, as I always tell people and tell our students, you get enormous benefit out by putting something in.
What you put in, yeah.
And by participating actively in the committee, first the younger members, then the regional committee. As I've already said, you meet these people and then you get onto the national committee, you broaden the network of people there, and the benefits that brings, just knowing people, that awareness, is enormously beneficial. And you wouldn't, my view is, I wouldn't have got it any other way, possibly ever, and certainly not that quickly.
That's a really interesting point. Thank you, Nigel. That it sounds like you said, it was a great leveler, and you had access to various places and individuals, and you're all striving towards the same goal. It's a great process that you've just described. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, how you said how you've supported the IET by sitting on these various committees. How, if we flip it the other way, how has the institution, the IEE or the IET now, supported you in your career?
Right. Well, obviously, in several ways. The first one I've already alluded to is that network of people and meeting senior people. And when you meet people, just talking to them, you learn about careers and you learn about what they're doing. And you sort of upskill yourself in that way. You also learn how they behave, you learn a bit of the softer skills from them, of how to present, how to operate a meeting, how to conduct yourself in a professional manner. All of that, it emerges. Osmosis, I think, is the phrase, isn't it? It sort of seeps into you. So you're surrounded by professional people like that. You learn from them. Then, of course, by getting involved with organizing events or attending events, you learn from a subject point of view about what's going on in your field because you attend special lectures or colloquia. So that always helps. And also, of course, there is the encouragement, dare I say, pressure from the committee that you've really got to sort out your professional membership and make sure you get, because of course those days we had, as a graduate, I became an associate member of the IEE. In order to become a full member, you had to have so many years in industry and training beyond your degree, and you had to apply. And of course, that also brought with it chartered engineer. Now, clearly, that's something I aspired to do. But there was that extra peer pressure from the local committee, which is kind of, well, you can't become junior vice chairman if you're not a member. You know, you've got to get rid of this associate. You've really got to apply and get yourself. Have you put your application form in yet? You know, and it's all good stuff. So I obviously was encouraged to get my application sorted for my membership and chartered status. And again, once you've got that, letters, people then recognize that you have not just academic qualifications, but you've got something else. And so that all always helps as well. It might have been more critical had I been in industry rather than university, because in academic terms, you know, being a member, being a chartered engineer wasn't really a block to anything. Right. Whereas in a lot of companies, I do know the culture was, if you weren't a chartered engineer, you couldn't do certain things. You know, you couldn't sign off this contract. Mm-hmm. You couldn't manage that project because you're not a chartered engineer. I hadn't got those restrictions. But even so, that sort of credibility of being a chartered engineer and so on is important. And so that's something which the professional body has given me as well. So there are all sorts of benefits, as I say, some subject related, some professional recognition, and others which are that sort of those softer skills that you just learn from being involved, and how to conduct a meeting, how to write an agenda, how to do the minutes, all of these things come from
and
being involved.
And I suppose it's a reciprocal relationship as well. They in industry, they would find out what everyone's doing in the academic side as well, what the latest trends are and what's been taught the students and so forth.
And also when I applied for research grants, if you needed an industrial collaborator, I had a network of contacts, and I could, even if the person I knew wasn't the person directly involved in what I was doing, they were a conduit to that person. And so that was a great help as well.
So the idea of networking.
Oh, critical. Yeah.
Yeah. Which brings us back to the institution's original aims of a meeting place and a networking space for like-minded individuals.
And also when you organize an event, let's say a national event for the IEE, a colloquia in Savoy Place, and it goes well and you have a great attendance and you get a lot of feedback, that makes you feel good. You know, you get a lot of personal satisfaction from having run a successful event. And that then can translate into things you might be organising that have nothing to do with the IEE. So if I'm running a conference at Salford, the experience I gained from running an event at Savoy Place feeds in to how to run an event in your own
transferable
institution.
Skills.
Yeah. I mean, so you don't get the support of the IEE secretariat, which is absolutely critical, of course. You know, you've got to do that thing yourself. But nevertheless, all those skills are great. And so you learn how to do these things because you've done it within the IEE and you've seen how it's done.
That's great. Thank you, Nigel. You touched on your professional registration there.
Yeah.
Could you just describe for our audience the process that you had to go through? Because that's something quite alien to people who don't know what a professional organisation does.
Yes, of course. As I say, when I started at the university as an undergraduate, our degree course was accredited by the IEE. Mm. It had already been checked and approved as meeting the educational requirements. So when I graduated, I'd already satisfied the IEE that I had the right level of education. But of course, to become a member, and the days I'm talking about, when you became, you couldn't become a member of the IEE without also becoming chartered. The chartered and membership were integrated. They were the same thing. But in order to become a member, you had to develop, you had to demonstrate your professional competence. So the degree confirms your skill set from a knowledge point of view, but not from a can you do the job point of view. Yep. Now, I have to say, of course, that the bulk of the members of the IEE are industry based. So when you read the forms, or when I read the forms, it was all about what have you done in industry? And I thought, well, that doesn't work like that at universities. That's not how it works. So I actually waited longer than the recommended either 2 or 4 years. I've forgotten which it was. I think it was 4 years. I waited a bit longer because I felt my career, my profile didn't instinctively tick the boxes in the way going to work for a company, being a practicing engineer would do. So I waited a few years. In fact, the panel who assessed me told me off for waiting too long. but I thought, well, actually, I'd rather wait too long and get it as go too early and be and not get it and feel a bit humiliated. Yeah. Yeah. So I was cautious. I waited for more years than it turns out I needed to, but that's why I did it. Because I felt that as an academic, you know, you're teaching students, you're developing course materials, but you're not really running a commercial project. You know, you're not doing a commercial project in the way that industry would see that. So you've got to map what I'm doing to the criteria. And to me, I thought, well, I want to be sure about this. So I, as I say, waited and completed my application form. You had to find some referees. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you see, that's where being active in the IEE helped me.
Your networking.
Kind of, I had loads of people I could ask. You know, obviously, I had colleagues in the university. Mm. When it says, do you know anybody in industry? Yes, I do. Yeah. I have a big, long list because of the committee. So that was easy. Mm. Had a good, and they were very supportive because they know you in the committee, and they wanted me to do it. So, you know, they were clearly going to support me, you know, do with the referee. So that was good. That was easy. So you do all the paperwork, get your referees, and then you had to have an oral assessment and sit before a panel of people who are effectively already chartered engineers and members of the IEE. And they talk to you about your job and your responsibilities and what you do. And they obviously have to satisfy themselves that you are demonstrating a level of professional competence beyond, well, you might know your subject, but can you actually do the job? Mm-hmm. And that's their role. So you've done the paperwork and evidence, and you've now had the oral as well. And based on that, that committee, that group makes a recommendation that you should become chartered and a member of the IEE. And I'm delighted to say that I got through it. So I did become a member. Yeah.
Was it quite terrifying being up against a panel of people? Were they quite nice?
In one sense, not too bad, because I was so used to the educational environment of, if you like, me being on the panel, subjecting students to the project orals or whatever. So the environment of being in that situation wasn't alien. All right, I was on the other side of the table. Mm. But equally, they're not trying to catch you out. Mm. You know what you've got, you know what you do. And it's not that terrifying in the sense of, well, what can they ask me that I don't know? I'm not a job interview. You know,
it's about yourself, isn't it?
You don't know yourself. And I knew the criteria. Yeah. And obviously, I was familiar with the IEE. So when they ask you about the professional body and, you know, what do you do? I was able to give them chapter and verse on that, you know. So I wasn't short of that side of it either, which was good. So yeah, I got the chartered engineering status with my membership at that time. Remember, the two were intimately connected. You couldn't have one without the other. So that gave me the professional status. And then several years later, of course, I stepped it up a gear and applied for the fellowship. And that again is based on seniority. Yeah. So numbers of years, but also the role that you're doing. It's not just a case of you've done enough years, tick the box. Mm-hmm. It's also have you got senior responsibility? And within my job, you get senior responsibility as an academic from being in charge of a program. You know, you become what we call the program leader, or we used to call it course tutor. You start developing new programs. You might get a management role in the university. So those all reflect a seniority of position. And obviously, when you've moved into that sort of senior roles, you acquire that senior experience. That's when you're able to apply for fellowship of the IEE. And I, of course, by then it was the IET. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for fellowship as later in life. Yeah.
And was that a similar process? Did you have to go against the panel for that? Or
no, I don't. I can't remember. I certainly paperwork. I can't remember whether there was a panel or not. Strange that, because I have a very vivid memory of the chartered panel, but not of the fellowship. I think it went to fellowship committee. And again, referees, of course. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just done as a committee assessment. I think with fellowship, wasn't it a case of if the committee wasn't confident there was the option of an oral? It could have been that. Right. It could have been that. I'm guessing a little bit of reflection there. But I don't recall having a face-to-face on that one.
Just the chartership then. That was the
chartership
that
I remember quite vividly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. That's a really good overview of how the whole process worked. And you've touched on it already again. You were very heavily involved with activities and events and publications and so forth. But were there any that particularly inspired you? Were there any
Can I just say that I thoroughly enjoyed all of that. I didn't do any of it reluctantly. I did genuinely enjoy it, and I didn't do it. I wasn't motivated. You know, I talked about the benefit of the network of people you gained. I never went in with that purpose or intent. I didn't get involved in the IEE thinking, oh, this will give me a good network of people and this will do my career good. Actually, it wasn't like that. I got those benefits, but I never consciously sought them out. I actually genuinely enjoyed what I did for the IEE and obviously running an event. I didn't do it because I felt I had, you know, I did it because I wanted to, and I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
And the benefits came out of it. So I actually found it, I wasn't a reluctant committee member in that sense. I wasn't press ganged.
Yeah.
I did genuinely enjoy it and get pleasure out of it. So it was a positive experience.
Excellent. I
think obviously when you, it's strange really, because in the regional committees, when I was on the Learned Society, which was effectively the program committee, it sorted out all of the events that were being organized in Manchester. So you would have a power section, you would have a control and automation section, and all these people would bring their events together, and they'd all have to be coordinated through the Learned Society committee. So being on that committee, you saw the whole spectrum of activity that was going on. And people would say, oh, it was a first-class event. We had 60 people there. And somebody else would say, no, it was very disappointing. We only had six people there. And you think, well, hang on a minute. But for those six people, they probably thought it was the best event of the year. So how you assess success and so on was interesting, that some people felt, well, as long as we get a lot of people in the room, it was a successful event. But of course, that, you know why you feel that. If you've organized an event and you've got people, the room is full, you feel good about it. If the room's half empty, you feel less good about it. But for the people in the room, the experience that they get is what really matters. So when we talk about what was really successful, then I think you've got to decide what you're measuring it by. You know, yes, I've organized events where I've had 100 plus people in the room. And I've had events where I've had a lot less than that. But were they really lesser quality? I don't think so. And the other good thing, because you were the IEE, if you phoned up somebody and said, would you like to come and give a talk to the IEE in Manchester? It carried some weight. And you actually could get people to come and talk to you who might have been reluctant to do anything like that for some other organization. And I did get, and I was very honored to get this person. He was a very famous scientist from the Second World War. He was called R.V. Jones. He subsequently died. But his job was military intelligence in the Second World War, scientific intelligence. And I got him to come and talk in Manchester. We filled the room with him, talked 200 plus, you know. And he, you know, to get somebody like that, of that kind of caliber, because you were the IEE, that was enormously rewarding. Just meeting the guy, you know, I knew about his work, I'd read his book, I'd seen his documentaries. And you kind of think he's untouched, you know, he's out of reach, but no, he wasn't. He did a great job. But that's one thing. But obviously, if you run an event about a subject which is very topical, and you feel that, yes, you've got, you know, we've got people in the room who can tell you about the latest developments, and they are at the cutting edge, that's also massively rewarding as well, because obviously you're doing something for your subject and your discipline when you do that.
And I suppose the idea is that when you get people like your lecturer in, you're hoping that you're going to inspire the next generation as well. That's the whole idea, isn't it? I suppose that someone might come along to that lecture or that event that you've put on and go, actually, yeah, this is the thing that I'm, you know, this has sparked something in me.
Yeah, that's, absolutely.
This is the idea, isn't it? That you're then informing the next generation, hopefully, as well.
Which, you know, is exactly what I talked about childhood, watching programs like Tomorrow's World and the scientific orientated programs did to me, particularly things like, again in the 70s, the Royal Institution Christmas lectures.
I remember
Professor Eric Laithwaite did a series of lectures. We got him to talk in Manchester. He was a University of Manchester lecturer. You know, so there I was at an IEE event with Eric Laithwaite stood up in front, and I'd only ever seen him on television.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he'd be, you know, that sort of thing. I used to watch the Christmas lectures. If they weren't really, you know, if they were more about biology and nature, I was less keen. But but the other were very inspirational. And, you know, things like that. The television, of course, in the 70s wasn't like it is now. There wasn't YouTube and thousands of catch up hours of television. It was scheduled. You know, the very little in terms of hours of programming compared to today. It wasn't 24/7. So you had to, you know, there wasn't a plethora of content you could have dipped into. It was a bit more restricted than it is now. You know, today, if you want to know about any technology, there's bound to be a YouTube video there somewhere which you can go and watch. We didn't have that in the 70s. That's not how it was. the 70s or the 80s. So perhaps I got more inspiration from that which I saw because of that, because it was rarer. It had a bigger impact, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
I think that's there's lots to be said for impact there. Yeah. That's great. Well, moving on more to sort of a bit of evaluation. What does the IET mean to you? And have you got any thoughts for engineering in the future and how the IET has to adapt to be, you know, to stay relevant?
Yeah, because obviously, as part of my job, teaching students, and I teach a module in the first year on professionalism. So I stress the importance of professional bodies and what they do. And I actually, because of my subject, as I said, I started in electronics. I did a PhD, which was moved me into computer networking. So I also felt that I needed to join the British Computer Society, BCS, because I needed to see, if you like, the involvement of that community. And in recent years, I've joined the Institute of Telecommunications Professionals because, again, that's where my career's gone. And I actually have all three. I haven't left one to join the others. I actually am now a member of all three of those organizations, three professional bodies, and over the years have participated actively in all of them. So I'm very passionate about engaging with the professional institutions and encourage our students to do that. I think it's always today students, I think it's a little bit harder to convince them of the benefits of joining the professional body, partly because they think they can get access to information without being a member.
Yeah.
And again, you've got to rewind to my career and the period we're talking about. And, you know, when I was doing a degree in 1980 to 83, there was no World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no Google, there's no YouTube, there's none of that stuff. And access to information was harder. So being a member of the professional body helped because you had, that was a good access to information. And I think because it's seemingly easier to access information now, maybe that benefit has been a bit diluted in the minds of students. And they're thinking, well, what will I get out of this? And what you tend to find is that the first year students don't really see the benefit. But as they go through their career and start looking for job placements and then jobs, suddenly they realize that, oh, actually, there are some benefits here. So they tend to start coming a bit later, I think, in the cycle. What's, I guess, the professional bodies have to do is engage with how information is disseminated to the members, and bearing in mind the younger age have a different way of doing this. Their social media generation, they don't consume information in quite the way that I did when I was their age. And so the professional bodies have always got to find new ways of engaging with their methods of learning and interaction. So, you know, it is all the social media stuff. It is YouTube. It is TikTok and Twitter,
Instagram,
and Facebook and Instagram.
Short videos, isn't
that's where they are. And that's how they're consuming the information. So that side of it, I think, has to always evolve. You know, the printed E&T magazine is probably not going to engage first year students because they don't tend to read magazines online or not. They're like little snippets. So I think that's one way. Clearly, the skills that the IET offers, skills training, interview techniques, and all of those things, they're always going to be valuable to the younger age group, the student member. But of course, we've always had this so-called bathtub of engagement, where you kind of have engagement when they're relatively young, then when they're settled in their job and they've got all the family commitments and mm-hmm. life gets in top of everything, they disengage a bit.
Yep.
And then when they're retired or get more senior, they come back again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always been there. I know we've had, I remember discussions way back in the IEE about that membership bathtub curve and everything. Mm-hmm. I don't think that'll ever change. So, you know, I think you've got to keep the offer to, you know, if we don't recruit the young ones, we won't have an institution in 30 mm-hmm. years' time because there won't be a membership to support okay. it.
Yeah.
So you've got to move with the young end. And of course, the thing about the IEE, IET, it's always had a healthy younger members activity and section. Mm. And that is important. And it's got to be taken seriously further up the chain. Because clearly, if you don't adapt to what the younger age group wants, as I say, you won't notice the effect straight away, but give it 20 years sure. and you'll suddenly be yeah. panicking about where's yeah. all the members coming from. Mm-hmm. And it's too late then to get them mm-hmm. in. So there's always this challenge of how do you keep it current for the young end? And of course, the same is true in universities. Mm. How we deliver the material to students is different to what it used to be. Because we have to adapt to the way that the students consume
right,
content.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we don't do that, then we have issues here about the whole educational system. So the educational system has to evolve as well. And so the professional bodies are the same, I think.
Mm. Wow, a lot to take in there, isn't it? A lot to consider. But
I'm sure that discussion, here, I don't yeah. think there's any... I bet if you go back... into the annals yes. of IEE yep. proceedings or the Institute of Telegraph Engineers.
Oh, yes.
Society of Telegraph Engineers yes. predecessor. You'll yes. probably see the same discussions
the same
there.
Conversations, yes,
I bet
definitely.
It hasn't ever yes. really gone away.
No. As long as you evolve and you stay relevant and you offer
right.
something, you offer something that they might not get access to, like we were saying about the access to various committees and networks and things like that. Those are the sort of things that are core. And if we can offer those, you know, the lectures and
yeah, that's right, and specialist
like that.
Conferences and things,
exactly,
which
yeah.
you wouldn't hear about that. You know, I yeah. in January of this year, I attended my first conference on 6G.
Oh, wow.
Which was organised by the IET in Savoy Place. So I came down to Savoy Place in January to attend the conference there. And again, you know, nobody knows what 6G is yet. but the IET is running an event, brings people together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you go away thinking, well, you know what? The people in that room know as much as anyone else about 6G at the moment. So I'm happy. I've yeah. heard from those yeah. people.
But I've got a good contact here. So, yeah.
And, you know, that's how I wouldn't have got that any other way. Mm. So that's a good way of doing it. You know, an event can be, I guess the problem you have when you are searching for material yourself, it's wide open. And you're not really sure which bit is the most important, and it's a difficult thing. Whereas if you've got an event which has been organised by people who know the subject mm-hmm. and they pull it together and structure it, then you go to that, you get a lot more out of it because actually it's been curated in a way mm-hmm. that would have taken you a lot longer to try yeah. and do that yourself. So that's the benefit of going to a focused event like a one-day mm. seminar or colloquia, or indeed, of course, in universities, that's why you do a course,
mm.
because it's been designed mm-hmm. to take you through the steps that are relevant mm. by people who have the knowledge.
Mm.
So that dissemination of knowledge, the learned society model, which underpins all the professional bodies, is still key.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Oh, well, that's a really good place to finish, I think, there.
Right.
yeah, I mean, I've taken up a lot of your time and it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you. So I think we'll just conclude this interview to say thank you ever so much for your time. and for helping us to capture your story and the story of the IET and how it's worked with you from, you know, from being a student right up to your fellowship and, you know, and beyond. So we're extremely grateful. Thank you very much, Nigel.
Well, thank you, Asha. Appreciate it and really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you ever so much, Nigel.
Okay, thank you.